Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell contains footnotes that are integral to the story. The footnotes are included here in their original order within each chapter, and each has its own audio track. Audio Renaissance and Bloomsbury Publishing present Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell by Susanna Clarke. Read for you by Simon Preble. Volume 1. Mr. Norrell. He hardly ever spoke of magic, and when he did, it was like a history lesson, and no one could bear to listen to him. Chapter 1. The Library at Hurtview. Autumn 1806 to January 1807. Some years ago, there was in the city of York a society of magicians. They met upon the third Wednesday of every month and read each other long, dull papers upon the history of English magic. They were gentlemen magicians, which is to say, they had never harmed anyone by magic, nor ever done anyone the slightest good. In fact, to own the truth, not one of these magicians had ever cast the smallest spell, nor by magic caused one leaf to tremble upon a tree, made one mote of dust to alter its course, or changed a single hair upon anyone's head. But with this one minor reservation, they enjoyed a reputation as some of the wisest and most magical gentlemen in Yorkshire. A great magician has said of his profession that his practitioners must pound and rack their brains to make the least learning go in, but quarrelling always comes very naturally to them. Footnote 1. The History and Practice of English Magic by Jonathan Strange, Volume 1, Chapter 2, Publisher John Murray, London, 1816. And the York magicians had proved the truth of this for a number of years. In the autumn of 1806, they received an addition in a gentleman called John Segundus. At the first meeting that he attended, Mr. Segundus rose and addressed the society. He began by complimenting the gentlemen upon their distinguished history. He listed the many celebrated magicians and historians that had at one time or another belonged to the York Society. He hinted that it had been no small inducement to him in coming to York to know of the existence of such a society. Northern magicians, he reminded his audience, had always been better respected than southern ones. Mr. Segundus said that he had studied magic for many years and knew the histories of all the great magicians of long ago. He read the new publications upon the subject and had even made a modest contribution to their number, but recently he had begun to wonder why the great feats of magic that he read about remained on the pages of his book and were no longer seen in the street or written about in the newspapers. Mr. Segundus wished to know, he said, why modern magicians were unable to work the magic they wrote about. In short, he wished to know why there was no more magic done in England. It was the most commonplace question in the world. It was the question which sooner or later every child in the kingdom asks his governess or his schoolmaster or his parent. Yet the learned members of the York Society did not at all like hearing it asked, and the reason was this. They were no more able to answer it than anyone else. The president of the York Society, whose name was Dr. Foxcastle, turned to John Segundus and explained that the question was a wrong one.
"It presupposes that magicians have some sort of duty to do magic, which is clearly nonsense. You would not, I imagine, suggest that it is the task of botanists to devise more flowers, or that astronomers should labour to rearrange the stars? Magicians, Mr. Segundus, study magic which was done long ago. Why should anyone expect more?"
An elderly gentleman with faint blue eyes and faintly coloured clothes, called either Hart or Hunt, Mr. Segundus could never quite catch the name, faintly said that it did not matter in the least whether anybody expected it or not. A gentleman could not do magic. Magic was what street sorcerers pretended to do in order to rob children of their pennies. Magic, in the practical sense, was much fallen off. It had low connections. It was the bosom companion of unshaven faces, gypsies, housebreakers, the frequenter of dingy rooms with dirty yellow curtains. Oh, no, a gentleman could not do magic. A gentleman might study the history of magic, nothing could be nobler, but he could not do any. The elderly gentleman looked with faint, fatherly eyes at Mr. Segundus, and said that he hoped Mr. Segundus had not been trying to cast spells. Mr. Segundus blushed. But the famous magician's maxim held true. Two magicians, in this case Dr. Foxcastle and Mr. Hunt, or Hart, could not agree without two more thinking the exact opposite. Several of the gentlemen began to discover that they were entirely of Mr. Segundus's opinion, and that no question in all of magical scholarship could be so important as this one. Chief among Mr. Segundus's supporters was a gentleman called Honeyfoot, a pleasant, friendly sort of man of 55, with a red face and grey hair. As the exchanges became more bitter, and Dr. Foxcastle grew in sarcasm towards Mr. Segundus, Mr. Honeyfoot turned to him several times and whispered such comfort as, "Do not mind them, sir, I am entirely of your opinion," and, "You're quite right, sir, do not let them sway you," and, "You've hit upon it, indeed you have, sir. It was the want of the right question which held us back before. Now that you are come, we shall do great things." Such kind words as these did not fail to find a grateful listener in John Segundus, whose shock showed clearly in his face. "I fear that I have made myself disagreeable," he whispered to Mr. Honeyfoot. "That was not my intention. I had hoped for these gentlemen's good opinion." At first, Mr. Segundus was inclined to be downcast, but a particularly spiteful outburst from Dr. Foxcastle roused him to a little indignation. "That gentleman," said Dr. Foxcastle, fixing Mr. Segundus with a cold stare, "seems determined that we should share in the unhappy fate of the Society of Manchester magicians." Mr. Segundus inclined his head towards Mr. Honeyfoot and said, "I had not expected to find the magicians of Yorkshire quite so obstinate. If magic does not have friends in Yorkshire, where may we find them?" Mr. Honeyfoot's kindness to Mr. Segundus did not end with that evening. He invited Mr. Segundus to his house in High Petergate to eat a good dinner in company with Mrs. Honeyfoot and her three pretty daughters, which Mr. Segundus, who was a single gentleman and not rich, was glad to do. After dinner, Miss Honeyfoot played the pianoforte, and Miss Jane sang in Italian. The next day, Mrs. Honeyfoot told her husband that John Segundus was exactly what a gentleman should be, but she feared he would never profit by it, for it was not the fashion to be modest and quiet and kind-hearted. The intimacy between the two gentlemen advanced very rapidly. Soon Mr. Segundus was spending two or three evenings out of every seven at the house in High Petergate. Once there was quite a crowd of young people present, which naturally led to dancing. It was all very delightful, but often Mr. Honeyfoot and Mr. Segundus would slip away to discuss the one thing which really interested both of them. Why was there no more magic done in England? But talk as they would, often till two or three in the morning, they came no nearer to an answer. And perhaps this was not so very remarkable, for all sorts of magicians and antiquarians and scholars have been asking the same question for rather more than 200 years. Mr. Honeyfoot was a tall, cheerful, smiling gentleman with a great deal of energy, who always liked to be doing or planning something, rarely thinking to inquire whether that something were to the purpose. The present task put him very much in mind of the great medieval magicians. Footnote 2. More properly called Oriette, or Golden Age magicians. Who, whenever they had some seemingly impossible problem to solve, would ride away for a year and a day with only a fairy servant or two to guide them, and at the end of this time never failed to find the answer. Mr. Honeyfoot told Mr. Segundus that in his opinion they could not do better than emulate these great men, some of whom had gone to the most retired parts of England and Scotland and Ireland, where magic was strongest, while others had ridden out of this world entirely, and no one nowadays was quite clear about where they had gone or what they had done when they got there. Mr. Honeyfoot did not propose going quite so far. Indeed, he did not wish to go far at all, because it was winter, and the roads were very shocking. Nevertheless, he was strongly persuaded that they should go somewhere and consult someone. He told Mr. Segundus that he thought they were both growing stale. The advantage of a fresh opinion would be immense. But no destination, no object presented itself. Mr. Honeyfoot was in despair. And then he thought of the other magician. Some years before, the York Society had heard rumours that there was another magician in Yorkshire. This gentleman lived in a very retired part of the country, where, it was said, he passed his days and nights studying rare magical texts in his wonderful library. Dr. Foxcastle had found out the other magician's name and where he might be found, and had written a polite letter inviting the other magician to become a member of the York Society. The other magician had written back, expressing his sense of the honour done him, and his deep regret. He was quite unable, the long distance between York and Hertfew Abbey, the indifferent roads, the work that he could on no account neglect, etc., etc. The York magicians had all looked over the letter and expressed their doubts that any body with such small handwriting could ever make a tolerable magician. Then, with some slight regret for the wonderful library they would never see, they had dismissed the other magician from their thoughts. But Mr. Honeyfoot said to Mr. Segundus that the importance of the question, why was there no more magic done in England, was such that it would be very wrong of them to neglect any opening. Who could say? The other magician's opinion might be worth having. And so he wrote a letter proposing that he and Mr. Segundus give themselves the satisfaction of waiting on the other magician on the third Tuesday after Christmas at 2:30. A reply came very promptly. Mr. Honeyfoot, with his customary good nature and good fellowship, immediately sent for Mr. Segundus and showed him the letter. The other magician wrote in his small handwriting that he would be very happy in the acquaintance. This was enough. Mr. Honeyfoot was very pleased and instantly strode off to tell Waters, the coachman, when he would be needed. Mr. Segundus was left alone in the room with the letter in his hand. He read, "I am, I confess, somewhat at a loss to account for the sudden honour done to me. It is scarcely conceivable that the magicians of York, with all the happiness of each other's society and the incalculable benefit of each other's wisdom, should feel any necessity to consult a solitary scholar such as myself." There was an air of subtle sarcasm about the letter. The writer seemed to mock Mr. Honeyfoot with every word. Mr. Segundus was glad to reflect that Mr. Honeyfoot could scarcely have noticed, or he would not have gone with such elated spirits to speak to Waters. It was such a very unfriendly letter that Mr. Segundus found that all his desire to look upon the other magician had quite evaporated. "Well, no matter," he thought. "I must go because Mr. Honeyfoot wishes it, and what, after all, is the worst that can happen? We will see him and be disappointed, and that will be the end of it." The day of the visit was preceded by stormy weather. Rain had made long, ragged pools in the bare brown fields. Wet roofs were like cold stone mirrors, and Mr. Honeyfoot's post-chaise travelled through a world that seemed to contain a much higher proportion of chill grey sky and a much smaller one of solid, comfortable earth than was usually the case. Ever since the first evening, Mr. Segundus had been intending to ask Mr. Honeyfoot about the Learned Society of Magicians of Manchester, which Dr. Foxcastle had mentioned. He did so now. "It was a society of quite recent foundation," said Mr. Honeyfoot, "and its members were clergymen of the poorer sort, respectable ex-tradesmen, apothecaries, lawyers, retired mill-owners, who got up a little Latin and so forth, such people as might be termed half-gentlemen. I believe Dr. Foxcastle was glad when they disbanded. He doesn't think that people of that sort have any business becoming magicians. And yet, you know, there were several clever men among them. They began, as you did, with the aim of bringing back practical magic to the world. They were practical men, and wished to apply the principles of reason and science to magic, as they had done to the manufacturing arts. They called it rational thaumaturgy. When it didn't work, they became discouraged. Well, they cannot be blamed for that, but they let their disillusionment lead them into all sorts of difficulties. They began to think that there was not now, nor ever had been, magic in the world. They said that the Orient magicians were all deceivers, or were themselves deceived, and that the Raven King was an invention of the Northern English to keep themselves from the tyranny of the South. Being North Country men themselves, they had some sympathy with that. Oh, their arguments were very ingenious.
I forget how they explained fairies. They disbanded, as I told you, and one of them, whose name was Aubrey, I think, meant to write it all down and publish it. But when he came to the point, he found that a sort of fixed melancholy had settled on him, and he was not able to rouse himself enough to begin. "Poor gentleman," said Mr. Segundus. "Perhaps it is the age. It is not an age for magic or scholarship, is it, sir? Tradesmen prosper, sailors, politicians, but not magicians. Our time is past." He thought for a moment. 3 years ago," he said, "I was in London, and I met with a street magician, a vagabonding yellow curtain sort of fellow, with a strange disfiguration. This man persuaded me to part with quite a high sum of money, in return for which he promised to tell me a great secret. And when I had paid him the money, he told me that one day magic would be restored to England by two magicians. Now I do not at all believe in prophecies, yet it is thinking on what he said that has determined me to discover the truth of our fallen state. Is not that strange?"
"You were entirely right. Prophecies are great nonsense," said Mr. Honeyfoot, laughing.
And then, as if struck by a thought, he said,
"We are two magicians, Honeyfoot and Segundus," he said, trying it out, as if thinking how it would look in the newspapers and history books. "Honeyfoot and Segundus. It sounds very well."
Mr. Segundus shook his head. "The fellow knew my profession, and it was only to be expected that he should pretend to me that I was one of the two men. But in the end, he told me quite plainly that I was not. At first, it seemed as if he was not sure of it. There was something about me. He made me write down my name, and looked at it a good long while."
"I expect he could see there was more money to be got out of you," said Mr. Honeyfoot.
Hertfew Abbey was some 14 miles northwest of York. The antiquity was all in the name. There had been an abbey, but that was long ago. The present house had been built in the reign of Anne. It was very handsome and square and solid-looking, in a fine park full of ghostly-looking wet trees, for the day was becoming rather misty. A river, called the Hurt, ran through the park, and a fine classical-looking bridge led across it. The other magician, whose name was Norrell, was in the hall to receive his guests. He was small, like his handwriting, and his voice when he welcomed them to Hurtfew was rather quiet, as if he were not used to speaking his thoughts out loud. Mr. Honeyfoot, who was a little deaf, did not catch what he said.
"I get old, sir, a common failing. I hope you will bear with me."
Mr. Norrell led his guests to a handsome drawing-room with a good fire burning in the hearth. No candles had been lit. Two fine windows gave plenty of light to see by, although it was a grey sort of light and not at all cheerful. Yet the idea of a second fire, or candles, burning somewhere in the room kept occurring to Mr. Segundus, so that he continually turned in his chair and looked about him to discover where they might be. But there was never anything, only perhaps a mirror or an antique clock. Mr. Norrell said he had read Mr. Segundus's account of the careers of Martin Pale's fairy servants. Footnote 3. A complete description of Dr. Pale's fairy servants, their names, histories, characters, and the services they performed for him, by John Segundus, published by Thomas Burnham, bookseller, Northampton, 1799.
"A creditable piece of work, sir, but you left out Master Fallowthought, a very minor spirit, certainly, whose usefulness to the great Dr. Pale was questionable."
Footnote 4. Dr. Martin Pale, 1485 to 1567, was the son of a Warwick leather tanner. He was the last of the Oriat or Golden Age magicians. Other magicians followed him, C.F. Gregory Absalom, but their reputations were debatable. Pale was certainly the last English magician to venture into fairy.
"Nevertheless, your little history was incomplete without him."
There was a pause.
"A fairy spirit called Fallowthought, sir," said Mr. Segundus. That is to say, I never heard of any such creature in this world or any other."
Mr. Norrell smiled for the first time, but it was an inward sort of smile.
"Of course," he said. "I am forgetting. It's all in the Holgarth and Pickles history of their own dealings with Master Fallowthought, which you could scarcely have read. I congratulate you. They were an unsavory pair, more criminal than magical. The less one knows of them, the better.
Ah, sir, cried Mr. Honeyfoot, suspecting that Mr. Norrell was speaking of one of his books.
Oh, we hear marvellous things of your library. All the magicians in Yorkshire fell into fits of jealousy when they heard of the great number of books you had got.
Indeed, said Mr. Norrell coldly.
You surprise me. I had no idea my affairs were so commonly known. I expect it is Thoroughgood, he said thoughtfully, naming a man who sold books and curiosities in Coffee Yard in York. Childermas has warned me several times that Thoroughgood is a chatterer.
Mr. Honeyfoot did not quite understand this.
If he had had such quantities of magical books, he would have loved to talk of them, be complimented on them, and have them admired.
And he could not believe that Mr. Norrell was not the same. Meaning, therefore, to be kind, and to set Mr. Norrell at his ease, for he had taken it into his head that the gentleman was shy, he persisted.
Might I be permitted to express a wish, sir, that we might see your wonderful library?
Mr. Segundus was certain that Norrell would refuse, but instead Mr. Norrell regarded them steadily for some moments. He had small blue eyes and seemed to peep out at them from some secret place inside himself. And then, almost graciously, he granted Mr. Honeyfoot's request. Mr. Honeyfoot was all gratitude, happy in the belief that he had pleased Mr. Norrell as much as himself. Mr. Norrell led the other two gentlemen along a passage. A very ordinary passage, thought Mr. Segundus, panelled and floored with well-polished oak and smelling of beeswax. Then there was a staircase, or perhaps only three or four steps, and then another passage, where the air was somewhat colder, and the floor was good York stone, all entirely unremarkable, unless the second passage had come before the staircase or steps, or had there in truth been a staircase at all. Mr. Segundus was one of those happy gentlemen who can always say whether they face north or south, east or west. It was not a talent he took any particular pride in. It was as natural to him as knowing that his head still stood upon his shoulders. But in Mr. Norrell's house, his gift deserted him. He could never afterwards picture the sequence of passageways and rooms through which they had passed, nor quite decide how long they had taken to reach the library. And he could not tell the direction. It seemed to him as if Mr. Norrell had discovered some fifth point of the compass. Not east, nor south, nor west, nor north, but somewhere quite different. And this was the direction in which he led them. Mr. Honeyfoot, on the other hand, did not appear to notice anything odd. The library was perhaps a little smaller than the drawing-room they had just quitted. There was a noble fire in the hearth, and all was comfort and quiet. Yet once again, the light within the room did not seem to accord with the three tall 12-paned windows, so that once again Mr. Segundus was made uncomfortable by a persistent feeling that there ought to have been other candles in the room, other windows, or another fire, to account for the light. What windows there were looked out upon a wide expanse of dusky English rain, so that Mr. Segundus could not make out the view, nor guess where in the house they stood. The room was not empty. There was a man sitting at a table who rose as they entered, and whom Mr. Norrell briefly declared to be Childermas, his man of business. Mr. Honeyfoot and Mr. Segundus, being magicians themselves, had not needed to be told that the library of Hertfew Abbey was dearer to its possessor than all his other riches, and they were not surprised to discover that Mr. Norrell had constructed a beautiful jewel box to house his heart's treasure. The bookcases, which lined the walls of the room, were built of English woods and resembled Gothic arches laden with carvings. There were carvings of leaves, dried and twisted leaves, as if the season the artist had intended to represent were autumn. Carvings of intertwining roots and branches, carvings of berries and ivy, all wonderfully done. But the wonder of the bookcases was nothing to the wonder of the books. The first thing a student of magic learns is that there are books about magic and books of magic. And the second thing he learns is that a perfectly respectable example of the former may be had for 2 or 3 guineas at a good bookseller, and that the value of the latter is above rubies. Footnote 5. Magicians, as we know from Jonathan Strange's maxim, will quarrel about anything and many years of much learning has been applied to the vexed question of whether such and such a volume qualifies as a book of magic. But most laymen find they are served well enough by this simple rule. Books written before magic ended in England are books of magic. Books written later are books about magic. The principle from which the layman's rule of thumb derives is that a book of magic should be written by a practicing magician, rather than a theoretical magician or a historian of magic. What could be more reasonable? And yet already we are in difficulties. The great masters of magic, those we term the Golden Age or Orient magicians, Thomas Godbless, Ralph Stokesy, Catherine of Winchester, the Raven King, wrote little or little has survived. It is probable that Thomas Godbless could not write. Stokesy learnt Latin at a little grammar school in his native Devonshire, but all we know of him comes from other writers. Magicians only applied themselves to writing books when magic was already in decline. Darkness was already approaching to quench the glory of English magic. Those men we call the Silver Age or Argentine magicians, Thomas Lanchester, 1518 to 90, Jacques Bellacy, 1526 to 1604, Nicholas Goubert, 1535 to 78, Gregory Absalom, 1507 to 99, were flickering candles in the twilight. They were scholars first and magicians second. Certainly they claimed to do magic, some even had a fairy servant or two, but they seem to have accomplished very little in this way, and some modern scholars have doubted whether they could do magic at all. The collection of the York Society was reckoned very fine, almost remarkable. Among its many volumes were five works written between 1550 and 1700, which might reasonably be claimed as books of magic, although one was no more than a couple of ragged pages. Books of magic are rare, and neither Mr. Segundus nor Mr. Honeyfoot had ever seen more than two or three in a private library. At Hertview, all the walls were lined with bookshelves, and all the shelves were filled with books, and the books were all, or almost all, old books. Books of magic. Oh, to be sure, many had clean modern bindings, but clearly these were volumes which Mr. Norrell had had rebound. He favoured, it seemed, plain calf with the title stamped in neat silver capitals. But many had bindings that were old. Old, old, with crumbling spines and corners. Mr. Segundus glanced at the spines of the books on a nearby shelf. The first title he read was How to Put Questions to the Dark and Understand Its Answers. A foolish work, said Mr. Norrell. Mr. Segundus started. He had not known his host was so close by. Mr. Norrell continued. I would advise you not to waste a moment's thought upon it. So Mr. Segundus looked at the next book, which was Bellacy's Instructions. You know Bellacy's, I dare say? Asked Mr. Norrell. Only by reputation, sir, said Mr. Segundus. I have often heard that he held the key to a good many things, but I've also heard, indeed all the authorities agree, that every copy of the instructions was destroyed long ago. Yet now here it is. Why, sir, it is extraordinary. It is wonderful. You expect a great deal of Bellacy's, remarked Norrell. And once upon a time I was entirely of your mind. I remember that for many months I devoted 8 hours out of every 24 to studying his work. A compliment, I may say, that I have never paid to any other author. But ultimately, he is disappointing. He is mystical where he ought to be intelligible, and intelligible where he ought to be obscure. There are some things which have no business being put into books for all the world to read. For myself, I no longer have any great opinion of Bellacy's. Here is a book I never even heard of, sir, said Mr. Segundus. The Excellences of Christo-Judaic Magic. What can you tell me of this? Ha! Cried Mr. Norrell. It dates from the 17th century, but I have no great opinion of it. Its author was a liar, a drunkard, an adulterer, and a rogue. I'm glad he's been so completely forgot.
It seemed that it was not only live magicians which Mr. Norrell despised. He had taken the measure of all the dead ones, too, and found them wanting. Mr. Honeyfoot, meanwhile, his hands in the air like a Methodist praising God, was walking rapidly from bookcase to bookcase. He could scarcely stop long enough to read the title of one book before his eye was caught by another on the other side of the room.
"Oh, Mr. Norrell," he cried, "such a quantity of books! Surely we shall find the answers to all our questions here."
"I doubt it, sir," was Mr. Norrell's dry reply.
The man of business gave a short laugh, laughter which was clearly directed at Mr. Honeyfoot. Yet Mr. Norrell did not reprimand him either by look or word, and Mr. Segundus wondered what sort of business it could be that Mr. Norrell entrusted to this person. With his long hair as ragged as rain and as black as thunder, he would have looked quite at home upon a windswept moor, or lurking in some pitch-black alleyway, or perhaps in a novel by Mrs. Radcliffe. Mr. Segundus took down the instructions of Jacques Bellesis, and despite Mr. Norrell's poor opinion of it, instantly hit upon two extraordinary passages. Footnote 6. The first passage which Mr. Segundus read concerned England, Faery, which magicians sometimes call the Other Lands, and a strange country that is reputed to lie on the far side of hell. Mr. Segundus had heard something of the symbolic and magical bond which linked these three lands, yet never had he read so clear an explanation of it as was put forward here. The second extract concerned one of England's greatest magicians, Martin Pale. In Gregory Absalom's The Tree of Learning, there is a famous passage which relates how, while journeying through Faery, the last of the great Orient magicians, Martin Pale, paid a visit to a fairy prince. Like most of his race, the fairy had a great multitude of names, honorifics, titles, and pseudonyms, but usually he was known as Cold Henry. Cold Henry made a long and deferential speech to his guest. The speech was full of metaphors and obscure allusions, but what Cold Henry seemed to be saying was that fairies were naturally wicked creatures who did not always know when they were going wrong. To this, Martin Pale briefly and somewhat enigmatically replied that not all Englishmen have the same size feet. For several centuries, no one had the faintest idea what any of this might mean, though several theories were advanced, and John Segundus was familiar with all of them. The most popular was that developed by William Pantler in the early 18th century. Pantler said that Cold Henry and Pale were speaking of theology. Fairies, as everybody knows, are beyond the reach of the church. No Christ has come to them, nor ever will. And what is to become of them on Judgment Day, no one knows. According to Pantler, Cold Henry meant to inquire of Pale if there was any hope that fairies, like men, might receive eternal salvation. Pale's reply, that Englishmen's feet are different sizes, was his way of saying that not all Englishmen will be saved. Based on this, Pantler goes on to attribute to Pale a rather odd belief that heaven is large enough to hold only a finite number of the blessed. For every Englishman who is damned, a place opens up in heaven for a fairy. Pantler's reputation as a theoretical magician rests entirely on the book he wrote on the subject. In Jacques Bellesis's instructions, Mr. Segundus read a very different explanation. 3 centuries before Martin Pale set foot in Cold Henry's castle, Cold Henry had had another human visitor, an English magician even greater than Pale, Ralph Stokesy, who had left behind him a pair of boots. The boots, said Bellesis, were old, which is probably why Stokesy did not take them with him. But their presence in the castle caused great consternation to all its fairy inhabitants, who held English magicians in great veneration. In particular, Cold Henry was in a pickle because he feared that in some devious, incomprehensible way, Christian morality might hold him responsible for the loss of the boots. So he was trying to rid himself of the terrible objects by passing them on to Pale, who did not want them. Then, conscious of time passing, and of the queer dark eye of the man of business upon him, he opened the excellences of Christo-Judaic magic. This was not, as he had supposed, a printed book, but a manuscript scribbled down very hurriedly upon the backs of all kinds of bits of paper, most of them old alehouse bills. Here Mr. Segundus read of wonderful adventures. The 17th-century magician had used his scanty magic to battle against great and powerful enemies, battles which no human magicians ought to have attempted. He had scribbled down the history of his patchwork victories just as those enemies were closing around him. The author had known very well that as he wrote, Time was running out for him, and death was the best that he could hope for. The room was becoming darker. The antique scrawl was growing dim on the page. Two footmen came into the room and, watched by the unbusinesslike man of business, lit candles, drew window curtains, and heaped fresh coals upon the fire. Mr. Segundus thought it best to remind Mr. Honeyfoot that they had not yet explained to Mr. Norrell the reason for their visit. As they were leaving the library, Mr. Segundus noticed something he thought odd. A chair was drawn up to the fire, and by the chair stood a little table. Upon the table lay the boards and leather bindings of a very old book, a pair of scissors, and a strong, cruel-looking knife, such as a gardener might use for pruning. But the pages of the book were nowhere to be seen. Perhaps, thought Mr. Segundus, he had sent it away to be bound anew. Yet the old binding still looked strong, and why should Mr. Norrell trouble himself to remove the pages and risk damaging them? A skilled bookbinder was the proper person to do such work. When they were seated in the drawing-room again, Mr. Honeyfoot addressed Mr. Norrell.
"What I have seen here today, sir, convinces me that you are the best person to help us. Mr. Segundus and I are of the opinion that modern magicians are on the wrong path. They waste their energies upon trifles. Do you not agree, sir?"
"Oh, certainly," said Mr. Norrell.
"Our question," continued Mr. Honeyfoot, "is why magic has fallen from its once great state in our great nation. Our question is, sir, why is no more magic done in England?"
Mr. Norrell's small blue eyes grew harder and brighter, and his lips tightened as if he were seeking to suppress a great and secret delight within him. It was as if, thought Mr. Segundus, he had waited a long time for someone to ask him this question, and had had his answer ready for years. Mr. Norrell said,
"I cannot help you with your question, sir, for I do not understand it. It is a wrong question, sir. Magic is not ended in England. I myself am a quite tolerable, practical magician."
Chapter 2. The Old Star Inn, January to February, 1807. As the carriage passed out of Mr. Norrell's sweep gate, Mr. Honeyfoot exclaimed,
"A practical magician in England, and in Yorkshire, too. We have had the most extraordinary good luck. Ah, Mr. Segundus, we have you to thank for this. You were awake when the rest of us had fallen asleep. Had it not been for your encouragement, we might never have discovered Mr. Norrell, and I'm quite certain that he would never have sought us out. He is a little reserved. He gave us no particulars of his achievements in practical magic, nothing beyond the simple fact of his success. That, I fancy, is the sign of a modest nature. Mr. Segundus, I think you will agree that our task is clear. It falls to us, sir, to overcome Norrell's natural timidity and aversion to praise, and lead him triumphantly before a wider public."
"Perhaps," said Mr. Segundus doubtfully.
"No, I do not say it will be easy," said Mr. Honeyfoot. "He is a little reticent and not fond of company, but he must see that such knowledge as he possesses must be shared with others for the nation's good. He is a gentleman. He knows his duty and will do it, I'm sure. Ah, Mr. Segundus, you deserve the grateful thanks of every magician in the country for this."
But whatever Mr. Segundus deserved, the sad fact is that magicians in England are a peculiarly ungrateful set of men. Mr. Honeyfoot and Mr. Segundus might well have made the most significant discovery in magical scholarship for three centuries. What of it? There was scarcely a member of the York Society who, when he learnt of it, was not entirely confident that he could have done it much better. And upon the following Tuesday, when an extraordinary meeting of the Learned Society of York Magicians was held, there were very few members who were not prepared to say so. At 7 o'clock upon the Tuesday evening, the upper room of the Old Star Inn in Stonegate was crowded. The news which Mr. Honeyfoot and Mr. Segundus had brought seemed to have drawn out all the gentlemen in the city who had ever peeped into a book of magic, and York was still, after its own fashion, one of the most magical cities in England. Perhaps only the King's City of Newcastle could boast more magicians. There was such a crush of magicians in the room that for the present a great many were obliged to stand, though the waiters were continually bringing more chairs up the stairs. Dr. Foxcastle got himself an excellent chair, tall and black and curiously carved, and this chair, which rather resembled a throne, and the sweep of the red velvet curtains behind him, and the way in which he sat with his hands clasped over his large round stomach, all combined to give him a deeply magisterial air. The servants at the Old Star Inn had prepared an excellent fire to keep off the chills of a January evening, and around it were seated some ancient magicians, apparently from the reign of George II or thereabouts, all wrapped in plaid shawls with yellowing spider's web faces, and accompanied by equally ancient footmen with bottles of medicine in their pockets. Mr. Honeyfoot greeted them with, "How do you do, Mr. Aptree? How do you do, Mr. Greyship? I hope you are in good health, Mr. Turnstall. I'm very glad to see you here, gentlemen. I hope you have all come to rejoice with us. All our years in the dusty wilderness are at an end. Ah, no one knows better than you, Mr. Aptree, and you, Mr. Greyship, what years they have been, for you have lived through a great many of them. But now we shall see magic once more, Britain's counsellor and protector. And the French, Mr. Turnstall, what will be the feelings of the French when they hear about it? Why, I should not be surprised if it were to bring on an immediate surrender." Mr. Honeyfoot had a great deal more to say of the same sort. He had prepared a speech in which he intended to lay before them all the wonderful advantages that were to accrue to Britain from this discovery. But he was never allowed to deliver more than a few sentences of it, for it seemed that each and every gentleman in the room was bursting with opinions of his own on the subject, all of which required to be communicated urgently to every other gentleman. Dr. Foxcastle was the first to interrupt Mr. Honeyfoot. From his large black throne, he addressed Mr. Honeyfoot thus.
"I'm very sorry to see you, sir, bringing magic, for which I know you have a genuine regard, into disrepute with impossible tales and wild inventions. Mr. Segundus," he said, turning to the gentleman whom he regarded as the source of all the trouble, "I do not know what is customary where you come from, but in Yorkshire we do not care for men who build their reputations at the expense of other men's peace of mind."
This was as far as Dr. Foxcastle got before he was drowned by the loud, angry exclamations of Mr. Honeyfoot and Mr. Segundus's supporters. The next gentleman, to make himself heard, wondered that Mr. Segundus and Mr. Honeyfoot should have been so taken in. Clearly, Norrell was mad, no different from any stark-eyed madman who stood upon the street corner screaming out that he was the Raven King. A sandy-haired gentleman, in a state of great excitement, thought that Mr. Honeyfoot and Mr. Segundus should have insisted on Mr. Norrell leaving his house upon the instant and coming straight away in an open carriage, though it was January, in triumph to York, so that the sandy-haired gentleman might strew ivy leaves in his path. Footnote 1. The conquerors of Imperial Rome may have been honoured with wreaths of laurel leaves. Lovers and fortune's favourites have, we are told, roses strewn in their paths. But English magicians were always only ever given common ivy. And one of the very old men by the fire was in a great passion about something or other, but being so old, his voice was rather weak, and no one had leisure just then to discover what he was saying. There was a tall, sensible man in the room called Thorpe, a gentleman with very little magical learning, but a degree of common sense rare in a magician. He had always thought that Mr. Segundus deserved encouragement in his quest to find where practical English magic had disappeared to, though, like everyone else, Mr. Thorpe had not expected Mr. Segundus to discover the answer quite so soon. But now that they had an answer, Mr. Thorpe was of the opinion that they should not simply dismiss it.
"Gentlemen, Mr. Norrell has said he can do magic. Very well. We know a little of Norrell. We have all heard of the rare texts he's supposed to have, and for this reason alone we would be wrong to dismiss his claims without careful consideration. But the stronger arguments in Norrell's favour are these, that two of our own number, sober scholars both, have seen Norrell and come away convinced."
He turned to Mr. Honeyfoot.
"You believe in this man, and one may see by your face that you do. You've seen something that convinced you. Will you not tell us what it was?"
Now Mr. Honeyfoot's reaction to this question was perhaps a little strange. At first he smiled gratefully at Mr. Thorpe, as if this was exactly what he could have wished for, a chance to broadcast the excellent reasons he had for believing that Mr. Norrell could do magic. And he opened his mouth to begin, Then he stopped. He paused. He looked about him, as if those excellent reasons which had seemed so substantial a moment ago were all turning to mist and nothingness in his mouth, and his tongue and teeth could not catch hold of even one of them to frame it into a rational English sentence. He muttered something of Mr. Norrell's honest countenance. The York Society did not think this very satisfactory, and had they actually been privileged to see Mr. Norrell's countenance, they might have thought it even less so. So Thorpe turned to Mr. Segundus and said, "Mr. Segundus, you've seen Norrell too. What is your opinion?" For the first time, the York Society noticed how pale Mr. Segundus was, and it occurred to some of the gentlemen that he had not answered them when they had greeted him, as if he could not quite collect his thoughts to reply.
"Are you unwell, sir?" asked Mr. Thorpe gently.
"No, no," murmured Mr. Segundus. "It is nothing, I thank you." But he looked so lost that one gentleman offered him his chair, and another went off to fetch a glass of canary wine, and the excitable sandy-haired gentleman, who had wished to strew ivy leaves in Mr. Norrell's path, nurtured a secret hope that Mr. Segundus might be enchanted, and that they might see something extraordinary. Mr. Segundus sighed and said, "I thank you. I'm not ill, but this last week I felt very heavy and stupid. Mrs. Pleasance has given me arrowroot and hot concoctions of licorice root, but they have not helped, which does not surprise me, for I think the confusion is in my head. I'm not so bad as I was. If you were to ask me now, gentlemen, why it is that I believe that magic has come back to England, I should say it is because I have seen magic done. The impression of having seen magic done is most vivid here and here." Mr. Segundus touched his brow and his heart. "And yet I know that I have seen none. Norrell did none while we were with him, and so I suppose I have dreamt it." Fresh outbreak of the gentlemen of the York Society. The faint gentleman smiled faintly and inquired if anyone could make anything of this. Then Mr. Thorpe cried,
"Good God, it's very nonsensical for us to all sit here and assert that Norrell can or cannot do this or can or cannot do that. We're all rational beings, I think, and the answer surely is quite simple. We will ask him to do some magic for us, in proof of his claims."
This was such good sense that for a moment the magicians were silent, though this is not to say that the proposal was universally popular, not at all. Several of the magicians, Dr. Foxcastle was one, did not care for it. If they asked Norrell to do magic, there was always the danger that he might indeed do some. They did not want to see magic done. They only wished to read about it in books. Others were of the opinion that the York Society was making itself very ridiculous by doing even so little as this. But in the end, most of the magicians agreed with Mr. Thorpe that,
"As scholars, gentlemen, the least we can do is offer Mr. Norrell the opportunity to convince us."
And so it was decided that someone should write another letter to Mr. Norrell. It was quite clear to all the magicians that Mr. Honeyfoot and Mr. Segundus had handled the thing very ill, and upon one subject at least, that of Mr. Norrell's wonderful library, they did seem remarkably stupid, for they were not able to give any intelligible report of it. What had they seen? Oh, books, many books. A remarkable number of books? Yes, they believed they had thought it remarkable at the time. Rare books? Ah, probably. Had they been permitted to take them down and look inside them? Oh, no, Mr. Norrell had not gone so far as to invite them to do that.
But they had read the titles.
Yes, indeed.
Well, then, what were the titles of the books they had seen?
They did not know. They could not remember. Mr. Segundus said that one of the books had a title that began with a B, but that was the beginning and end of his information. It was very odd. Mr. Thorpe had always intended to write the letter to Mr. Norrell himself, but there were a great many magicians in the room whose chief idea was to give offence to Mr. Norrell in return for his impudence, and these gentlemen thought quite rightly that their best means of insulting Norrell was to allow Dr. Foxcastle to write the letter. And so this was carried. In due time, it brought forth an angry letter of reply.
Hertfew Abbey, Yorkshire, February 1st, 1807. Sir, Twice in recent years I have been honoured by a letter from the gentlemen of the Learned Society of York Magicians soliciting my acquaintance. Now comes a third letter, informing me of the Society's displeasure. The good opinion of the York Society seems as easily lost as it is gained, and a man may never know how he came to do either. In answer to the particular charge contained in your letter, that I have exaggerated my abilities and laid claim to powers I cannot possibly possess, I have only this to say. Other men may fondly attribute their lack of success to a fault in the world rather than to their own poor scholarship. But the truth is that magic is as achievable in this age as in any other, as I have proved to my own complete satisfaction any number of times within the last 20 years. But what is my reward for loving my art better than other men have done, for studying harder to perfect it? It is now circulated abroad that I am a fabulist. My professional abilities are slighted, and my word doubted. You will not, I dare say, be much surprised to learn that under such circumstances as these, I do not feel much inclined to oblige the York Society in anything, least of all a request for a display of magic. The Learned Society of York Magicians meets upon Wednesday next, and upon that day I shall inform you of my intentions. Your servant, Gilbert Norrell. This was all rather disagreeably mysterious. The theoretical magicians waited somewhat nervously to see what the practical magician would send them next. What Mr. Norrell sent them next was nothing more alarming than an attorney. A smiling, bobbing, bowing attorney. A quite commonplace attorney called Robinson, with neat black clothes and neat kid gloves, with a document the like of which the gentlemen of the York Society had never seen before. A draft of an agreement drawn up in accordance with England's long-forgotten codes of magical law. Mr. Robinson arrived in the upper room at the Old Star promptly at 8, and seemed to suppose himself expected. He had a place of business and 2 clerks in Coney Street. His face was well known to many of the gentlemen.
"I will confess to you, sirs," smiled Mr. Robinson, "that this paper is largely the work of my principal, Mr. Norrell. I am no expert upon thaumaturgic law. Who is nowadays? Still, I dare say that if I go wrong, you'll be so kind as to put me right again."
Several of the York magicians nodded wisely. Mr. Robinson was a polished sort of person. He was so clean and healthy and pleased about everything that he positively shone, which is only to be expected in a fairy or an angel, but is somewhat disconcerting in an attorney. He was most deferential to the gentlemen of the York Society, for he knew nothing of magic, but he thought it must be difficult and require great concentration of mind. But to professional humility and a genuine admiration of the York Society, Mr. Robinson added a happy vanity, that these monumental brains must now cease their pondering on esoteric matters for a time and listen to him. He put golden spectacles upon his nose, adding another small glitter to his shining person. Mr. Robinson said that Mr. Norrell undertook to do a piece of magic in a certain place at a certain time.
"You have no objection, I hope, gentlemen, to my principal settling the time and place?"
The gentleman had none.
"Then it shall be the cathedral, a Friday fortnight."
Footnote 2. The great church at York is both a cathedral, meaning the church where the throne of the bishop or archbishop is housed, and a minster, meaning a church founded by a missionary in ancient times. It has borne both these names at different periods. In earlier centuries, it was more usually called the minster, but nowadays the people of York prefer the term cathedral, as one which elevates their church above those of the nearby towns of Ripon and Beverley. Ripon and Beverley have minsters, but no cathedrals. Mr. Robinson said that if Mr. Norrell failed to do the magic, then he would publicly withdraw his claims to be a practical magician. Indeed, to be any sort of magician at all, and he would give his oath never to make any such claims again.
"We need not go so far," said Mr. Thorpe. "We have no desire to punish him. We merely wish to put his claims to the test."
Mr. Robinson's shining smile dimmed a little, as if he had something rather disagreeable to communicate, and was not quite sure how to begin. Wait, said Mr. Segundus. We have not heard the other side of the bargain yet. We have not heard what he expects of us.
Mr. Robinson nodded. Mr. Norrell intended, it seemed, to exact the same promise from each and every magician of the York Society as he made himself. In other words, if he succeeded, then they must, without further ado, disband the Society of York Magicians, and none of them claim the title magician ever again.
And after all, said Mr. Robinson, this would be only fair, since Mr. Norrell would then have proved himself the only true magician in Yorkshire.
And shall we have some third person, some independent party, to decide if the magic has been accomplished?
Asked Mr. Thorpe. This question seemed to puzzle Mr. Robinson. He hoped they would excuse him if he had taken up a wrong idea, he said. He would not offend for the world, but he had thought that all the gentlemen present were magicians.
Oh, yes, nodded the York Society. They were all magicians.
Then surely, said Mr. Robinson, they would recognize magic when they saw it. Surely there were none better qualified to do so. Another gentleman asked what magic Norrell intended to do. Mr. Robinson was full of polite apologies and elaborate explanations. He could not enlighten them. He did not know. It would tire my reader's patience to rehearse the many winding arguments by which the gentlemen of the York Society came to sign Mr. Norrell's agreement. Many did so out of vanity. They had publicly declared that they did not believe Norrell could do magic. They had publicly challenged Norrell to perform some. Under such circumstances as these, it would have looked peculiarly foolish to change their minds. Or so they thought. Mr. Honeyfoot, on the other hand, signed precisely because he believed in Norrell's magic. Mr. Honeyfoot hoped that Mr. Norrell would gain public recognition by this demonstration of his powers, and go on to employ his magic for the good of the nation. Some of the gentlemen were provoked to sign by the suggestion, originating with Norrell and somehow conveyed by Robinson, that they would not show themselves true magicians unless they did so. And so, one by one, there and then, the magicians of York signed the document that Mr. Robinson had brought. The last magician was Mr. Segundus.
I will not sign, he said, for magic is my life, and though Mr. Norrell is quite right to say I am a poor scholar, what shall I do when it is taken from me?
A silence.
Oh, said Mr. Robinson. Well, that is, are you quite sure, sir, that you should not like to sign the document? You see how all your friends have done it. You will be quite alone.
I'm quite sure, said Mr. Segundus. Thank you.
Oh, said Mr. Robinson. Well, in that case, I must confess that I do not know quite how to proceed. My principal gave me no instruction what to do if only some of the gentlemen signed. I shall consult with my principal in the morning.
Dr. Foxcastle was heard to remark to Mr. Hart, or Hunt, that once again it was the newcomer who brought a world of trouble upon everyone's heads. But 2 days later, Mr. Robinson waited upon Dr. Foxcastle with a message to say that on this particular occasion, Mr. Norrell would be happy to overlook Mr. Segundus's refusal to sign. He would consider that his contract was with all the members of the York Society, except for Mr. Segundus. The night before Mr. Norrell was due to perform the magic, snow fell on York, and in the morning the dirt and mud of the city had disappeared, all replaced by flawless white. The sounds of hooves and footsteps were muffled, and the very voices of York citizens were altered by a white silence that swallowed up every sound. Mr. Norrell had named a very early hour in the day. In their separate homes, the York magicians breakfasted alone. They watched in silence as a servant poured their coffee, broke their warm white bread rolls, fetched the butter. The wife, the sister, the daughter-in-law, or the niece who usually performed these little offices, was still in bed, and the pleasant female domestic chat, which the gentlemen of the York Society affected to despise so much, and which was, in truth, the sweet and mild refrain in the music of their ordinary lives, was absent. And the breakfast rooms where these gentlemen sat were changed from what they had been yesterday. The winter gloom was quite gone, and in its place was a fearful light. The winter sun, reflected many times over by the snowy earth, there was a dazzle of light upon the white linen tablecloth. The rosebuds that patterned the daughter's pretty coffee cups seemed almost to dance in it. Sunbeams were struck from the niece's silver coffee pot, and the daughter-in-law's smiling china shepherdesses were all becoming shining angels. It was as if the table were laid with fairy silver and crystal. Mr. Segundus, putting his head out of a third-story window in Lady Peckett's yard, thought that perhaps Norrell had already done the magic, and this was it. There was an ominous rumble above him, and he drew in his head quickly to avoid a sudden fall of snow from the roof. Mr. Segundus had no servant any more than he had a wife, sister, daughter, daughter-in-law, or niece. But Mrs. Pleasance, his landlady, was an early riser. Many times in the last fortnight she had heard him sigh over his books, and she hoped to cheer him up with a breakfast of two freshly grilled herrings, tea and fresh milk, and white bread and butter on a blue and white china plate. With the same generous aim, she had sat down to talk to him. On seeing how despondent he looked, she cried, "Oh, I have no patience with this old man." Mr. Segundus had not told Mrs. Pleasance that Mr. Norrell was old, and yet she fancied that he must be. From what Mr. Segundus had told her, she thought of him as a sort of miser who hoarded magic instead of gold. And as our narrative progresses, I will allow the reader to judge the justice of this portrait of Mr. Norrell's character. Like Mrs. Pleasance, I always fancy that misers are old. I cannot tell you why this should be, since I'm sure that there are as many young misers as old. As to whether or not Mr. Norrell was in fact old, he was the sort of man who had been old at 17. Mrs. Pleasance continued.
When Mr. Pleasance was alive, he used to say that no one in York, man or woman, could bake a loaf to rival mine. And other people as well have been kind enough to say that they never in their lives tasted bread so good. But I've always kept a good table for love of doing a thing well, and if one of these queer spirits from the Arabian fables came out of this very teapot now and gave me three wishes, I hope I would not be so ill-natured as to try and stop other folk from baking bread. And should their bread be as good as mine, then I do not see that it hurts me, but rather is so much the better for them. Come, sir. Try a bit, she said, pushing a plateful of the celebrated bread towards her lodger. I do not like to see you get so thin. People will say that Hetty Pleasance has lost all her skill at housekeeping. I wish you would not be so downcast, sir. You've not signed this perfidious document, and when the other gentlemen are forced to give up, you'll still continue, and I very much hope, Mr. Segundus, that you may make great discoveries. And perhaps then this Mr. Norrell, who thinks himself so clever, will be glad to take you into partnership, and so be brought to regret his foolish pride.
Mr. Segundus smiled and thanked her. But I do not think that will happen. My chief difficulty will be lack of materials. I have very little of my own, and when the society is disbanded, well, I cannot tell what will happen to its books, but I doubt that they will come to me. Mr. Segundus ate his bread, which was just as good as the late Mr. Pleasance and his friends had said it was, and his herrings, and drank some tea. Their power to soothe a troubled heart must have been greater than he had supposed, for he found that he felt a little better, and fortified in this manner, he put on his greatcoat and his hat and his muffler and his gloves, and stamped off through the snowy streets to the place that Mr. Norrell had appointed for this day's wonders, the Cathedral of York. And I hope that all my readers are acquainted with an old English cathedral town, or I fear that the significance of Mr. Norrell's choosing that particular place will be lost upon them. They must understand that in an old cathedral town, the great old church is not one building among many. It is the building, different from all others in scale, beauty, and solemnity. Even in modern times, when an old cathedral town may have provided itself with all the elegant appurtenances of civic buildings, assembly, and meeting rooms, and York was well stocked with these, the cathedral rises above them, a witness to the devotion of our forefathers. It is as if the town contains within itself something larger than itself. When going about one's business in the muddle of narrow streets, one is sure to lose sight of the cathedral. But then the town will open out, and suddenly it is there, many times taller and many times larger than any other building. And one realizes that one has reached the heart of the town, and that all streets and lanes have in some way led here to a place of mysteries much deeper than any Mr. Norrell knew of. Such were Mr. Segundus's thoughts as he entered the close and stood before the great brooding blue shadow of the cathedral's west face. Now came Dr. Foxcastle, sailing magisterially around the corner like a fat black ship. Spying Mr. Segundus there, he steered himself towards that gentleman and bid him good morning.
"Perhaps, sir," said Dr. Foxcastle, "you would be so kind as to introduce me to Mr. Norrell. He is a gentleman I very much wish to know."
"I shall be only too happy, sir," said Mr. Segundus, and looked about him. The weather kept most people within doors, and there were only a few dark figures scuttling over the white field that lay before the great grey church. When scrutinized, these were discovered to be gentlemen of the York Society, or clergymen and cathedral attendants, vergers and beadles, sub-choirmasters, provosts, transept sweepers and such-like persons, who had been sent by their superiors out into the snow to see to the church's business.
"I should like nothing better, sir," said Mr. Segundus, "than to oblige you, but I do not see Mr. Norrell."
Yet there was someone. Someone was standing in the snow alone directly in front of the minster. He was a dark sort of someone, a not quite respectable someone, who was regarding Mr. Segundus and Dr. Foxcastle with an air of great interest. His ragged hair hung about his shoulders like a fall of black water. He had a strong, thin face with something twisted in it, like a tree root, and a long, thin nose, and though his skin was very pale, something made it seem a dark face. Perhaps it was the darkness of his eyes or the proximity of that long, black, greasy hair. After a moment, this person walked up to the two magicians, gave them a sketchy bow, and said he hoped they would forgive him intruding upon them, but they had been pointed out to him as gentlemen who were there upon the same business as himself. He said that his name was John Childermas, and that he was Mr. Norrell's steward in certain matters, though he did not say what these were.
"It seems to me," said Mr. Segundus thoughtfully, "that I know your face. I have seen you before, I think."
Something shifted in Childermas's dark face, but it was gone in a moment, and whether it had been a frown or laughter, it was impossible to say.
"I am often in York upon business for Mr. Norrell, sir. Perhaps you have seen me in one of the city's bookselling establishments."
"No," said Mr. Segundus. "I have seen you... I can picture you. Where? Oh, I shall have it in a moment."
Childermas raised an eyebrow, as if to say he very much doubted it.
"But surely Mr. Norrell is coming himself," said Dr. Foxcastle.
Childermas begged Dr. Foxcastle's pardon, but he did not think Mr. Norrell would come. He did not think Mr. Norrell saw any reason to come.
"Ah," cried Dr. Foxcastle, "then he concedes, does he? Well, 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 poor gentleman. He feels very foolish, I dare say. Well, indeed, it was a noble attempt at any rate. We bear him no ill will for having made the attempt."
Dr. Foxcastle was much relieved that he would see no magic, and it made him generous. Childermas begged Dr. Foxcastle's pardon once more. He feared that Dr. Foxcastle had mistaken his meaning. Mr. Norrell would certainly do magic. He would do it in Hertfew Abbey, and the results would be seen in York.
"Gentlemen," said Childermas to Dr. Foxcastle, "do not like to leave their comfortable firesides unless they must. I dare say if you, sir, could have managed the seeing part of the business from your own drawing-room, you would not be here in the cold and wet."
Dr. Foxcastle drew in his breath sharply and bestowed upon John Childermas a look that said that he thought John Childermas very insolent. Childermas did not seem much dismayed by Dr. Foxcastle's opinion of him. Indeed, he looked rather entertained by it. He said,
"It is time, sirs. You should take your stations within the church. You will be sorry, I'm sure, to miss anything when so much hangs upon it."
It was 20 minutes past the hour, and the gentlemen of the York Society were already filing into the cathedral by the door in the south transept. Several looked about them before going inside, as if taking a last fond farewell of a world they were not quite sure of seeing again. Chapter 3. The Stones of York, February 1807. A great old church in the depths of winter is a discouraging place at the best of times. The cold of 100 winters seems to have been preserved in its stones and to seep out of them. In the cold, dank twilight interior of the cathedral, the gentlemen of the York Society were obliged to stand and wait to be astonished, without any assurance that the surprise when it came would be a pleasant one. Mr. Honeyfoot tried to smile cheerfully at his companions, but for a gentleman so practiced in the art of a friendly smile, it was a very poor attempt. Upon the instant, bells began to toll. Now these were nothing more than the bells of St. Michael the Belfry telling the half hour, but inside the cathedral they had an odd faraway sound, like the bells of another country. It was not at all a cheerful sound. The gentlemen of the York Society knew very well how bells often went with magic, and in particular with the magic of those unearthly beings, fairies. They knew how, in the old days, silvery bells would often sound just as some Englishman or Englishwoman of particular virtue or beauty was about to be stolen away by fairies to live in strange, ghostly lands for ever. Even the Raven King, who was not a fairy but an Englishman, had a somewhat regrettable habit of abducting men and women and taking them to live with him in his castle in the other lands. The well-known ballad, The Raven King, describes just such an abduction. Not long, my father said, not long shall you be ours. The Raven King knows all too well which are the fairest flowers. The priest was all too worldly, though he prayed and rang his bell. The Raven King three candles lit. The priest said it was well. Her arms were all too feeble, though she claimed to love me so. The Raven King stretched out his hand. She sighed and let me go. This land is all too shallow, it is painted on the sky, and trembles like the wind-shook rain when the Raven King goes by. For always and for always, I pray, remember me, upon the moors beneath the stars, with the king's wild company. Now, had you and I the power to seize by magic any human being that took our fancy, and the power to keep that person by our side through all eternity, and had we all the world to choose from, then I dare say our choice might fall on someone a little more captivating than a member of the Learned Society of York Magicians. But this comforting thought did not occur to the gentlemen inside York Cathedral, and several of them began to wonder how angry Dr. Foxcastle's letter had made Mr. Norrell, and they began to be seriously frightened. As the sound of the bells died away, a voice began to speak from somewhere high up in the gloomy shadows above their heads. The magicians strained their ears to hear it. Many of them were now in such a state of highly strung nervousness that they imagined that instructions were being given to them as in a fairy tale. They thought that perhaps mysterious prohibitions were being related to them. Such instructions and prohibitions, the magicians knew from the fairy tales, are usually a little queer, but not very difficult to conform to, or so it seems at first sight. They generally follow the style of, do not eat the last candied plum in the blue jar in the corner cupboard, or do not beat your wife with a stick made from wormwood. And yet, as all fairy tales relate, circumstances always conspire against the person who receives the instructions, and they find themselves in the middle of doing the very thing that was forbidden to them, and a horrible fate is thereby brought upon their heads.